Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bruce Fein, former Assistant Deputy Attorney General under Ronald Reagan, who explains why he opposes President Obama's embrace of the Bush-era policy of indefinite detention for Guantanamo detainees. Josh Hoff, Communications Director with the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, who talks about the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. And former health insurance executive turned whistleblower Wendell Potter, who explains why the health insurance industry is quietly opposed to the Republican effort to repeal President Obama's new health care reform law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Shamed by war atrocities in Bosnia and genocide in Rwanda, world leaders signed a treaty to create the International Criminal Court in the late 1990s to prosecute war crimes. The court opened its doors in 2003 at The Hague, led by Argentine human rights lawyer Luis Morano Ocampo. The ICC focused mainly on civil conflicts in Africa and issued an arrest warrant for Sudan President Omar al-Bashir over atrocities in Darfur. The ICC became a player in conflict zones like northern Uganda, where war crimes prosecutors tried to arrest rebel leader Joseph Kony of the Lord's Resistance Army. The court was also involved in domestic politics in Kenya, where the ICC attempted to sort out who was responsible for the political violence surrounding the 2008 presidential election. Most of all, the court's credibility is on the line in Sudan, where President Bashir has defied the arrest warrant and travels freely in Africa. 12 years after it was created, the United States Senate has not ratified the treaty creating the ICC. Massive development and urbanization in China has led to new risks to the Asian giant's food supply from land degradation and overuse of fertilizers. This is the conclusion of Oliver de Schutter, the United Nations Special Rapporteur for the Right to Food. Over the last generation, tens of millions of Chinese have migrated to cities for work, seeking better opportunities and taking advantage of higher standards of living and higher nutrition levels. In contrast, rural and western China remains extremely poor, suffering from food inflation in the cost of eggs and meat, where many people often only eat two meals a day. Agricultural soil quality has declined with the overuse of fertilizers in addition to pollution and persistent drought. Urbanization is also taking its toll, chewing up over 20 million acres of farmland for industrial parks. Increasing affluence among the Chinese also means eating more meat, which puts added pressure on farmland to grow more grain and raise more cattle. At the same time, the right to protest deteriorating food safety is under attack by Chinese authorities. Activist Zhu Lianhe was recently put in jail for organizing a campaign to compensate victims of contaminated milk, which left 300,000 sick and at least 6 babies dead. 3 years ago, the United States Supreme Court rejected an appeal to overturn the federal law banning so-called partial birth abortion in the case of Gonzalez v. Carhart. The 5-4 ruling demonstrated the power of the court's conservative wing, led by Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Sam Alito. The ruling has encouraged anti-abortion activists in conservative states to push for more restrictions on reproductive choice. In Nebraska, Mike Flood, the legislature's speaker, led a successful drive to ban abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, the harshest restriction of any state in the country. The Nebraska law is so restrictive that it forced late-term abortion provider Leroy Carhart, who served women from across the Midwest, to leave the state. Anti-abortion activists now call the Nebraska law a model bill for a future challenge to abortion rights before the Supreme Court. Justice Anthony Kennedy, long seen as a swing vote on the Supreme Court, signaled he may be in favor of restrictions on abortion rights. In his opinion in the Gonzalez case, Kennedy noted the pain and regret a woman may have after having an abortion. In stinging dissent, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote, "This way of thinking reflects ancient notions of a woman's place in the family and under the Constitution that have long been discredited." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Under President Bush, many terrorist suspects who were rounded up after the 9/11 attacks were designated as unlawful enemy combatants and imprisoned without charge or trial at the Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, U.S. detention camp and elsewhere. When then-Illinois Senator Barack Obama ran for the presidency, he pledged to both close down Guantanamo and reverse what he and many other civil liberties advocates declared were Bush administration violations of the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. However, once in the White House, President Obama embraced many of the Bush-era policies related to the war on terrorism, including continued warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens, denial of due process of law to detainees, use of the state secrets doctrine to prevent accountability for violations of the law, and the threat of extrajudicial assassinations. Now, according to news reports, the president will soon issue an executive order outlining his administration's policy on indefinite detention, affecting some 48 prisoners being held at Guantanamo. Among the provisions said to be in the document are providing to detainees a minimal review of the government's rationale for continued detention every 6 months, and a more comprehensive annual review. While some civil liberties advocates say reviews would improve the status quo, they warn that the executive order would institutionalize indefinite detention. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Fine, an authority on the U.S. Constitution, who served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under President Ronald Reagan. Fine, who supported the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney, discusses his opposition to indefinite detention, his concern about unchecked executive power, and the erosion of constitutional protections.
The total number of detainees at Guantanamo from 2001 onward ranges in the neighborhood of 900 to 1,000. And say we're now down 48, 50 remaining detainees. A large percentage are from Yemen, and this executive order purports to address those. Now, the executive order really is a very minor tinkering with the status quo. That is, under Bush, a system called Combatant Status Review Tribunals was created to determine whether or not those who were detained at Guantanamo were indeed enemy combatants. It was a very fragile tribunal, if you will. The government's decision was viewed as presumptively correct. The detainee wasn't really given any notice of why he was viewed as an enemy combatant, simply asked, well, tell us why you shouldn't be an enemy combatant, without knowing any of the evidence that the government was relying on against them. The detainee couldn't offer evidence and witnesses in his own behalf. And so that system is the one that Obama is tinkering with. Perhaps his greatest flaw is structural. The founding fathers described the combination of judge, jury, prosecutor in a single branch as the very definition of tyranny. And that's what these tribunals are about. That is, the executive branch is judging the correctness of its own decision to capture and detain someone as an enemy combatant. And you can imagine the likelihood that they're going to find against themselves is very tiny. That's why we have in the ordinary due process system a requirement that an independent judge decide your case, not a member of the prosecution staff overseeing the prosecution deciding whether his subordinates got it right. But that's what Obama is tinkering with regard to this executive order. I think it simply shows that other than a few commas and semicolons, he and Bush and Cheney are on the same page.
Bruce, Congress made a law where they don't provide funds to transfer Guantanamo detainees to the United States to stand trial in civilian courts or to repatriate them if they are found to be innocent and there's a need to release them. How do you view this legal limbo that the people who are found to be innocent are now going to be placed, in which they can't get a trial, that they're not going to be even charged, some of these guys, and if they're found to be innocent, they cannot be released?
You know, maybe Franz Kafka perhaps would have had fun with this kind of situation, and it's not humorous because it relates to people's lives and liberties here. They are speaking of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal 2011, which the President Obama signed just about a week ago. And it states that Congress is prohibiting the use of any funds not only to transfer any Guantanamo detainee to the United States for trial, but also to release them. To release them because either the executive branch or the judicial branch has found that they're not enemy combatants. So we now have Congress ordering the incarceration of people simply because at one time there was an error in believing that they were an enemy combatant, which is a monstrous violation of due process. If there's any way that it can be challenged in court, in my mind, clearly will be held to be unconstitutional and shows you how the fraud that is being perpetrated by the American people when you have the Congress saying, well, now we're going to recite the Constitution and we're going to read it, and every day we'll set forth the constitutional provision that justifies what we have done. I can tell you they don't have any constitutional authority for that, and they surely do not understand the first inklings of due process, most important concept ever invented in the history of civilization. And you have to have process in order to treat persons with the dignity they command as human beings, even if you disagree with them and decide ultimately that they shouldn't get their way.
President Obama campaigned for the presidency, saying that he would reverse many of the Bush administration's what he described as violating the Constitution and the rule of law in this country. When he got into office, he pretty much did the opposite. He clung and embraced, as it's been said, many of the Bush administration's violations of civil liberties that he once decried. What course of action can the country take to really try to reverse this stuff? Are we going to have to wait for the Supreme Court to get a very solid case to find out what happens here? Or the Supreme Court, of course, in their conservative majority, may not see it the way a lot of citizens who are concerned about civil liberties see it.
Well, it's an excellent question, and unfortunately, I don't have a perfect answer, but I at least have some. Number one, I agree with you. Reliance on the U.S. Supreme Court is a very fragile reliance. The history of the court over 220 years is in the long run, they can put a few speed bumps in the road, but they're going to back down to prevailing political conventional wisdom. But it means that the American political culture has to insist that the voters will not support candidates for Congress who will tolerate a president doing these things. There's nothing that prevents Congress at any time for impeaching a president, and I supported the impeachment of Bush and Cheney for doing this, for what you would call crimes against the Constitution. It doesn't have to be a federal criminal offense. And members of Congress need to accept that responsibility. Otherwise, limits on the president are toothless. And it's going to be a long process. We cannot believe in a Pollyannish way that our political culture will turn around at any time soon. We can't leave it to others. History is biography. It's you and me and all us citizens. We've got to get the thrill of self-government back. You know, we don't want to be vassals. We may make errors, but there are errors, and we'll be accountable for it.
That was Bruce Fein, who served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under President Ronald Reagan. His latest book is titled American Empire Before the Fall. The new year started off violently in the occupied West Bank of Palestine when a 36-year-old woman, Jawahar Abu Rama, was overcome by tear gas fired by the Israeli army at protesters in the town of Bilin on December 31st. Jawahar died on New Year's Day. Villagers who participate in a weekly protest are joined each Friday by Israeli supporters and international solidarity activists who are demanding the rerouting of the separation barrier Israel has built, which cuts villagers off from their land. The Israeli Supreme Court has ruled in the Palestinians' favor, but the barrier remains. Abu Rama, the woman who died, was the sister of Bassem Abu Rama, who in April 2009 was also killed by an Israeli tear gas canister fired directly at him at a similar Friday demonstration in Berlin. Many other protesters have been injured by Israeli forces at the town's weekly protests. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Josh Huff, communications director with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation based in Washington, D.C. He spent almost 2 years as part of a Christian peacemaker team living with Palestinians under siege in South Hebron in the West Bank. He discusses the deteriorating situation in the West Bank and his group's letter sent to Combined Systems Inc., or CSI, the Pennsylvania-based corporation that supplies most of the tear gas canisters to the Israeli military.
The Abu Rahme family is a prominent family in the Bel-Ain area from which many of the nonviolent demonstrators have come and which has suffered disproportionate casualties as a result of Israel's violent repression of this nonviolent action. There have been a number of the male residents of that family have been imprisoned wrongfully. And then over the last weekend, Jawahar Abu Rahme, the 36-year-old woman from the same family, now the second person in the family to be killed from Israeli violent military repression of these weekly Friday demonstrations, in this case from the inhalation of tear gas. And so we're going to be continuing to put pressure on the State Department using these newly emerging cases of egregious Israeli military violations of human rights and international law, the wrongful killing of unarmed civilians in the West Bank, to continue to put this in front of U.S. policymakers and people who oversee the special relationship between the U.S. government and the Israeli government. And also the letter that one of our member groups has taken the lead in drafting directly to CSI, Combined Systems Incorporated, which is a U.S. company which manufactures, we are told, the vast majority of the tear gas canisters that are used by the Israeli military in this violent repression of nonviolent activists. The U.S. campaign, we're going to be presenting this letter to CSI, basically saying that you have to stop dispensing these materials to the Israeli military, because given the Israeli military is continuously, systematically violating your own instructions, CSI, and potentially also in violation of U.S. laws, including the Arms Export Control Act, which says that you can't use U.S. supplied weapons for these means, like we've been doing for several years with the Caterpillar Company, to basically demand that they stop providing these weapons to Israel. And using these specific horrifying stories like the death of Jawahar this last Friday to try to convince them of that. And then also sharing these communications with CSI with the State Department and whoever else in the U.S. government that we're able to speak with. And then also with the general public and the media to show the linkage that CSI is substantial responsibility for this horrible unfolding of events.
Josh Huff, when I was in Berlin for one of the regular Friday protests back in 2008, the Palestinians, their Israeli supporters, and the international solidarity activists who were there were completely nonviolent. But there were just a couple of Palestinian youths who were shooting stones with slingshots toward the Israeli soldiers. And then Israel used that to say the protest was not nonviolent. Your comment?
One, I would say, just look at the disproportionality of force. We're talking about not stone throwing against unarmed Israeli civilians, but stone throwing against very well-armed Israeli soldiers. I've been there also myself a couple of times during the Friday demonstration, and what I see there is very similar to what I've seen a lot more of, actually, in South Hebron, where I've worked much more extensively. Yeah, I mean, stone throwing youth is a pretty common feature of these interactions between local people and the occupation forces when they come to raise hell. The second thing I would point to is that, yes, under the laws of occupation, which Israel claims to follow, that are laid out in international law, to which Israel's government is a signatory, some types of military force are justified in the protection of Israeli citizens and Israeli military and police security personnel. And so at least part of the argument I think that they are using for their systematically overwhelming use of force against these people. But from what I've seen, the cases in which they're taking this action and using that argument to defend it is cases where the military or other security personnel are actually taking the initiative, are being instigators, coming in, trying to rile up the response from the youth of the village, and then severely punishing them in response to the inevitable reaction from the youth. And it's really incredibly impressive how in cases from Bel-Ain to Tuwani in South Hebron Hills, where I've worked most extensively, how the vast majority of people locally, including the youth, many of them consistently choose not to respond violently.
That was Josh Huff of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, a coalition of more than 300 organizations. Contact the campaign by calling their Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-332-0994 or visit their website at endtheoccupation.org. In their first week as the new majority in the House of Representatives, the Republican Party has pledged to schedule a vote to repeal the health care reform law passed by the previous Democratic Congress and signed into law by President Obama. With a 49-seat advantage in the House, the GOP will almost certainly succeed in passing repeal legislation. But with a Democratic Senate and the power of a presidential veto standing in their way, the Republicans' repeal effort will merely be a symbolic gesture toward their conservative base. Acknowledging the obstacles of repeal, House GOP leaders say they will attempt to defund implementation of the new health care reform law. While many progressive legislators and health care activists were unhappy with the absence of a public health insurance option in the final reform legislation, most Democrats say they will defend the law and its provisions that give the poor subsidies to buy health coverage and prevent insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. On a second front, the White House is defending lawsuits in federal court that are challenging the law's individual mandate, which compels most citizens to purchase private health insurance policies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance public relations executive for 20 years, turned whistleblower in 2008. Potter, now senior fellow on healthcare with the Center for Media and Democracy and author of a new book titled Deadly Spin, explains why the health insurance industry is quietly opposed to the GOP repeal effort, understanding that the new healthcare reform law will be an economic bonanza for them with 30 million new mandated customers.
The law itself has many flaws, but it does many good things as well, and it will make illegal some of the most egregious practices of the health insurance industry. And it will bring a lot of people into coverage that have not had insurance coverage for a long time, many of them. As many as 30 million Americans will have coverage once this legislation is fully implemented in 2014. And it will prohibit insurance companies from refusing to sell us insurance if we've had a pre-existing condition. It will require them to keep our children on the rolls until they turn 26 if they can't get insurance elsewhere. And it will prohibit them from dropping insurance when we get sick if they just don't want to pay our medical claims. It's a practice called rescission that the industry has been engaging in for quite a long time. In that regard, it does a lot of good. It falls short in that it doesn't bring everyone into coverage. There will still be probably 20 million people who don't have coverage. And it doesn't give the government the authority to regulate rates that insurance companies charge, at least at the federal level. So we will not have as much protection from the government in terms of price gouging from the insurance industry as I would hope that we would.
Well, from the perspective of someone who worked in the health insurance industry for some 20 years, what's the attitude of the insurance companies towards the new health care law, and specifically the individual mandate, which compels all Americans not eligible for government-run health programs like Medicare and Medicaid to purchase private insurance?
Well, the insurance industry likes this legislation quite a bit, in particular that provision, which was the main reason they were supportive of health care reform at all. They wanted to have the individual mandate enacted into law. That was the first priority, and they got that. The second priority was to make sure there was no public option included in the legislation, and they got that as well. So they will not want this legislation repealed, and what is going on behind the scenes certainly is that the insurance company's lobbyists are telling the Republican lawmakers, look, you probably have an obligation to the people who voted for you, who think that you are sincere in wanting to repeal this legislation. Go through the motions. You can have your vote on reform because we know it's not going to pass. It won't get through the Senate. And even if the Senate were to repeal the legislation along with the House, and the president would veto it. So it's not likely that it will be a successful effort. So it'll be, in my view, a big show. largely because the insurance industry does not want it repealed. In fact, I think they probably are telling the Republican lawmakers, who I think many of them genuinely think, as I did for many years, and the new ones in particular who are coming into Congress for the first time, that the free market should work in health care and health insurance. It just simply does not. And I saw the reasons for that and why it doesn't over the course of my 20-year career in the industry. But they haven't seen that. They don't understand the health insurance industry because they've never been an insider. So I can understand why, ideologically, they think that this legislation might not be a good thing, because it does impose more regulations on insurers, which insurers don't like, but they do like the individual mandate. And they will be telling these members of Congress, look, have this vote if you need to satisfy your voters, but we know, wink, wink, that it's not going to pass.
So in essence, what's going on in Washington this week will be political theater for the consumption of people who were led to believe and propagandized that this health care reform law was somehow a government takeover. It's actually, the way you describe it, it's more like an insurance takeover where they get 30 million more customers who have to buy their insurance.
Oh, absolutely. This legislation props up a private health insurance system in ways that I think that the conservatives and the Republicans probably don't understand, because they don't, again, understand the health care system as they should. But you're exactly right. It will be political theater. The insurance industry will benefit significantly from this because it will require us all to buy their products. It will mean that they will get billions and billions of dollars in new revenue from us and from the federal government, because clearly many of us would buy insurance now if we could afford it. And many people who are uninsured just simply cannot. Most of them are that way. So the federal government will be subsidizing their payments. So this can be a big windfall for the insurance industry, and it will ensure that the private insurance market can continue to exist. Without it, it would eventually crumble, because you cannot keep transferring more and more of the cost, or shifting more of the cost of health care from insurance companies and employers to individuals as they're trying to do now. That just is not something that's sustainable over the long haul.
That was former health insurance public relations executive turned whistleblower Wendell Potter. His new book is titled Deadly Spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Read Potter's blog at prwatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446, or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.